Recent developments in condensed matter physics generally goes under the name of topological insulators and superconductors. So here you see an illustration of how topology works. But the exciting thing is that this is now real materials which realizes these, some of the beautiful topological properties mathematicians and theoretical physicists have been discussing for many years. So first let me acknowledge my colleagues at Stanford, my group, Xiaoliang Qi, who is now a professor at Stanford, Andrew Brnovich, now a professor at Princeton, Hong Jingwu, now a professor at UC San Diego, and more recent students and postdocs. So you can see that this work spent for a couple of years already. But very recently, we have now developed extensive collaboration with experimentalists, the experimentalists at Stanford University, but also the very first experimental realization of these topological insulated states was discovered at the University of Würzburg in Germany under the leadership of Lorenz Mollenkamp. And also more recently with my colleagues at Institute of Physics in Beijing and Tsinghua University. So let me give you a brief outline about models and materials of topological insulators. And then maybe I will perhaps skip this part, but tell you about the general theory of topological insulators and then of topological superconductors. So in condensed matter physics, what is the kind of fundamental thing that we look for? We know that in chemistry, the thing that drove chemistry to the golden age was the search for new elements in chemistry that lasted, that gave the golden age of chemistry. And in particle physics, we try to look for fundamental new particles which are constituents of the universe. But in condensed matter physics, we of course deal with the same old electrons and protons which makes the ordinary matter. But the interesting thing is that when you put large number of them, they can form different phases of different states of matter. And that's the new thing we try to look for. And as you will see towards the later part of the talk, after you discover some new phases, there will be elementary excitations out of this phase, which looks different from the original electrons. And in particular, one exciting aspect of this field of topological insulators is that many exotic particles, which has been theorized in field theory, such as monopoles, Majorana fermions, the axions, which we haven't discovered yet in the fundamental universe, actually is very likely to appear here. So that's one aspect why it makes interesting. So when we talk about different states of matter, after we discovered quite a number of them, we like to find a systematic way of to understand and categorize them. And that principle is which works for most states of matter is called the principle of spontaneous broken symmetry, which is also very familiar in particle physics context, that if you have a spontaneously broken state, it gives you a new vacuum and may have different properties. But when you look at most states in condensed matter, for example, when you look at a crystal, when you take two atoms apart, their interaction is basically translationally invariant, rotationally invariant. However, in a crystalline environment, they are not. And that is the way you define a crystal, saying that it breaks the symmetry in that particular way. A magnet breaks the rotational symmetry. A superconductor breaks the gauge symmetry, a little bit more subtle, but nonetheless, it breaks the symmetry. So after the many, many such states are discovered, it looks like condensed matter physics is also almost finished, because you may discover some new state, but it follows the same principle or same idea. You can imagine a very complicated symmetry breaking pattern. After a while, you may ask, what's new? So, but a dramatic discovery, yeah?
Question.
Yeah. No, you can ask any question you want.
So I don't have rotational symmetry.
Yeah.
Am I a magnet?
And, no. A magnet breaks the rotational symmetry, but not everything that breaks rotational symmetry is a magnet.
So, excuse me, so this is how we define a crystal, that it's something with broken translation.
Yeah, but also, crystal also breaks. You not only break rotational symmetry, you also break translational symmetry. So you are kind of a solid form. Well, so human beings are a little bit complicated. Give me some simpler examples.
The serious question is, yeah. If we use, I love the idea of using this to define what a crystal or a water is, but it's just that it doesn't seem to be sufficient.
But usually it associates with a unique order parameter. So anything that breaks a symmetry, for example, a magnet, you take the magnetization to be the order parameter. When you look at the fundamental model, such as the Heisenberg model, it's completely rotational symmetric. But in the magnetized state, the magnet that you stick onto your refrigerator has the expectation value of magnetization.
So in the category of systems that have an order parameter called magnetization, the magnets are the ones that broke the
Yes. And if you give me a Hamiltonian, I can write down an operator which has a non-vanishing expectation value in the broken symmetry state. In the high temperature state of the magnet, this order parameter is zero and rotational symmetry is restored. Yeah, I'm talking about spontaneous symmetry breaking. That's the example I gave you, right? When you take two atoms apart out of the silicon. No. Spontaneous. Because when you look at the Hamiltonian for the crystal, the fundamental Hamiltonian is just the interaction of the silicon atoms, which is translationally invariant and rotationally invariant. And at high temperature, they all vaporize, and the order parameter is, again, zero. But in the crystalline state, when they're condensed, translation symmetry is broken from a any kind of translation to a discrete translation. Right? And a superconductor also have order parameter, like Fermi operator C-Diger, or more precise definition is called off-diagonal long-range order. But these are the things which is quite familiar in the particle physics context. In the Higgs phase, there's a broken symmetry. But something very interesting was discovered in 1980, and that is the quantum Hall effect. So in the quantum Hall effect, you have a two-dimensional system of the electron gas. You have a magnetic field which is pointing perpendicular to these two-dimensional electron gas. You attach some electrode, and you pass a current along the longitudinal direction, but you measure a voltage in the transverse direction. So the best setting of all these topological effects, there's always some transverse things going on, as we were discussing over lunch. So you pass a longitudinal current, and you can measure a voltage in the transverse direction. And of course, we learned that in high school physics, the reason for that is because the Lorentz force. The electron experiences a Lorentz force. That's why they're bending sideways. That's you can have a transverse voltage. But what we didn't learn at high school is in high school we learned that the voltage, transverse voltage divided by the longitudinal current called the Hall conductance or Hall resistance, in high school physics we learned it's a straight line. But what Klaus von Klitzing discovered at high magnetic field and low temperature is that it goes in precisely quantized steps. Okay, so in that system, there's nothing that can be defined as some kind of a spontaneous broken symmetry, but yet the value of the plateau, so when you express the conductance, you find that it's always some integer times E squared over H. E squared over H is some fundamental constants of nature. And something so precise, but yet so robust, you can throw a lot of dirt. You can cut your circuits in some sideways. It doesn't have to be, the setup of the experiment doesn't have to be precise. Yet the value of the quantization is now measured to be with a precision of one part in 100 or 10, or either 10 million or 100 million level precision, one part in 10 million or 100 million, right? So such things, so precisely quantized, must have a fundamental explanation. And the fundamental explanation is that this is a topological effect. So when you just do a simple computation, this is just a one-loop diagram, you compute the Hall resistance is just conductivity to external lines of magnetic fields. But when you carefully compute it, you find usually when you express some physical quantity, you do a computation, it's some integral. But that integral turns out to be a topological number. It's the first Chern number, which we know in from mathematics. So if you have two dimensions, you have a two-dimensional Brillouin zone, which can be viewed as a two torus. And the two torus, you have one form gauge potential and two form field strength that nicely is a topological number. So this integer turns out to be exactly an integer number. And if it's a topological invariant, you can do all sorts of things to it, it still become an integer. If you do dramatic things to it, it jumps to the next integer. So that's the thing that's so dramatic. But this is only formulated within non-interacting electron systems. So what we did back in 87, I guess, is that we formulated the description of the quantum Hall effect in terms of topological field theory in space-time. And that term, because in 2 plus 1 dimension, the only natural topological term you would write down or guess is the Chern-Simons term in 2 plus 1 dimension. And to the very presence of the epsilon tensor, which is used to define a topological field theory, which is independent of the metric, exactly give you the transversality that you give a current one way. If you take a functional derivative with respect to A, you find that the current is always transverse to the electric field. But it also give you a lot of other things, like fractional charge, fractional statistics, all come out of this topological field theory, right? So this is what some condensed matter physicists call an emergent behavior. You're putting electrons, which all have integer charge, and out comes the elementary excitations, which has E over 3, a fractional charge. So this kind of topological phenomena is truly fascinating. Not only it teaches about condensed matter physics, it can teach us something very broad, both about topological field theory and about the way nature works. So that's the other kind of states, right? We have spontaneously broken symmetry states, which is 99% of all condensed matter states you find. And in 1980, there's only one and single example discovered. The news I'm bringing to you today is that there's now a series of discoveries in condensed matter physics. A new class of topological state has been discovered. And that we predicted that theoretically in 2006, very specific for a given, well, not all material will have that. That will tell you what kind of material will have that property. But the first one ever discovered was in Mercury terrorite system. Mercury, terrorite, two well-known elements in the periodic table. When you bring them together to form a quantum well, they form a new class of topological states. The difference is that the previous example of the quantum Hall effect requires a magnetic field and breaks time reversal symmetry explicitly. But in the newly discovered system, it's a new universality class. It preserves time reversal symmetry. And soon after that, the experiment was carried out at the University of Würzburg in 2007, only less than 1 year later. And ever since then, there are some other materials discovered and also has been generalized from a two-dimensional system to a three-dimensional system. And right now, the subject is really exploding in condensed matter physics. And if you want to read something, the January issue of Physics Today has a cover page story. So it's now recognized that it's a new state of matter. And different from all the broken spontaneously broken symmetry states, but also different from the quantum Hall effect itself. So another motivation to tell you about that story is has to do with technology, right? So these days, when you put a laptop on your lap, it feels burning hot. The chip, as it's functioning, is in the past 50 years, it went through the progression of Moore's law. You double the number of transistors per unit area every 18 months. But the fundamental operating principle has always been the same. So per transistor, it consumes the same, it generates the same amount of heat. If you pack, if you double that amount every 18 months, you know, sooner or later it will be not functional, right? So why is it not functional? And that's because the electron basically inside the chip moves like that. We want to build an information superhighway, but deep down at the chip level, it's not like a highway system. So ideally, what we'd like to do is to build a principle of the operating principle inside the chip to have like exactly like the highway system that we have, separating the contour moving traffic into separate lanes so that we can avoid these random collisions and not to generate such tremendous amount of heat and maybe get our chips to function much better in the future. Now, how do you do that? So the idea is to write 2 equals to 1 plus 1. Okay, so if let's imagine the simplest one-dimensional system, right? So suppose you live in one dimension, and for now, forget about the fact that the electron has a spin. Now, if you live one dimension and you forget about the spin, what's the minimal degree of freedom you would have? You will still have to have 2 degrees of freedom, because you can move forward or you can move backwards. Now, if there's some impurity sitting on your way, you are happily moving forward. You bounce into an impurity, you will be kicked back. And that's the problem. If you have, even if you have a nice one-dimensional wire, there's no fundamental protection principle. If somebody happened to stick in an impurity, it will lead to dissipation, okay? So the idea is to build a highway system to separate these two channels spatially so that 2 becomes 1 plus 1. So that you get the forward moving channel going forward on the upper edge, because this is now a two-dimensional system. You can never do it in a purely one-dimensional system. But if you have a two-dimensional system, you can get the forward moving channel to move forward on the upper edge, and the backward moving channel to be confined in the lower edge. Okay? So in this case, what happens that if you hit an impurity? If you had hit an impurity, in principle, it can be kicked back. But in order to be kicked back, you have to be jumped all the way to the other lane, and only then you can move back, right? Because in the upper edge, things are only moving forward. And that probability is exponentially small. To encounter impurity that is so strong that can you jump, because the wave function is exponentially localized. So you have some exponential suppression. So as the width of the sample gets much larger than the localization length, this is, in physics, anything is exponentially small, we can set it safely to zero, right? So then the things happily move forward, and if it encounters impurity, it simply bypasses it and keeps on moving forward. So this situation is realized exactly in the quantum Hall effect. Quantum Hall effect is 2 equals to 1 plus 1. Because you see that in order to get to realize such a situation, you have to tell the electrons on the upper edge to only move forward. That situation explicitly breaks time reversal symmetry. And you can only make that to be possible when you have an external magnetic field. Basically, if you have an external magnetic field, then you have a sense for the electrons to move, right? Then the upper edge knows to go forward and lower edge knows how to move backward. And the basic picture is that inside, we all know from high school physics again that the electron forms cyclotron orbits. So inside they form cyclotron orbits and the currents exactly cancel each other. But at a boundary they wouldn't. So you get a net current. So this very simple equation, 2 equals to 1 plus 1, is very deep. And that in particle physics language is known as the Nielsen-Nomia theory, right? If you try to put chiral fermions, things only move in one direction, you cannot do that if you are in one dimension. You have to embed these into a higher dimensional thing, like when you simulate lattice gauge theory with neutrino chiral fermion. The best way to do it is to say 3 plus 1 is the boundary of 4 plus 1. Then you can do it. Chiral fermion can exist on a lattice as a boundary state of a higher dimensional thing. And this is exactly the same realization. One dimension, if you have purely right mover or forward mover, it's a chiral fermion. And you cannot have chiral fermion in one dimension, purely one dimensional thing. But if it's a holographic, if it's the boundary of a two-dimensional thing, you can realize that. So the basic idea, 2 equals to 1 plus 1, is a profound one that, that makes it happen. So now you say, if you can, but the problem with, you say, why don't we build the chips all based on this principle? But you cannot, because you need a huge magnetic field, about 10 Tesla. You cannot drag such a magnetic field onto your chip. Okay, so the discovery we made is to generalize 2 equals to 1 plus 1 to 4 equals to 2 plus 2. Okay? So what do I mean by that? Because the electron actually has a spin. It's not true that there are spinless electrons. The electron has spin up or spin down. So then you can separate. So then you have 4 channels, right? You can be spin up, spin down, forward, or backward. Okay? So then you can separate 4 equals to 2 plus 2. Now, of course, there are many ways to do 4 equals to 2 plus 2. But you find there's one and only way to write 4 equals to 2 plus 2 in an explicit time reversal invariant fashion. That's why this is dramatically new. It's not simply multiplied by a factor of 2 on both sides of the equation. 2 equals to 1 plus 1 can only be realized when you spontaneously break time when you explicitly break time reversal symmetry. But 4 equals to 2 plus 2 can be done in a way that's completely time reversal invariant. Why? Because under the reversal of the arrow of time, forward mover becomes backward mover, but spin up becomes spin down. So if you put a spin up forward mover and spin down backward mover on the upper edge, and the opposite case in the lower edge, that situation does not break time reversal symmetry. Therefore, in principle, you cannot realize this situation on a chip, but you can possibly realize this situation on a chip, because you don't need a magnetic field to make that to happen. Okay? But you say, well, maybe this is true, but what good is it? Because you still have 2 counter-moving traffic on the upper edge. If you hit something, wouldn't you be kicked back? And you say, when I look at this picture doesn't look so different from this picture. What's the big deal? You say in one dimension, you will have scattering in here. Why don't we have, if I hit some impurity, why don't I get kicked back? And the reason for that is deeply profound. So let me give you a very simple example, again, in daily life. If we have a nice optical instrument, usually they come with something called anti-reflecting coating, because you want to collect all the light you can possibly collect. So you actually put a thin dielectrical film on top, okay? So as Feynman explains, usually you think it's a bad thing to do, right? Because if I have nothing coating, maybe I should absorb more. But now you put something extra, you think naively that you might reflect more. But you forgot about the wave nature of light. Because light can be bounced from the first surface, and it can be bounced from the second surface. Naively, if you have two ways of bouncing, it gets worse. But not because light is a wave phenomenon. That you can adjust the thickness of the dielectrical film in such a way that these two possible ways of bouncing interfere with each other destructively. So this is the principle of anti-reflecting coating. That if you put such a dielectrical film, there's no reflection. The light goes through completely because the two reflecting paths exactly cancel each other. But such a principle is not robust because you have to choose the thickness of your dielectrical film exactly correctly. And if you choose it correctly for one wavelength of the light, say it works for yellow, it wouldn't work for blue. Now, but let's think about a similar principle, but now looking at the edge states of the quantum spin-Hall effect, 4 = 2+2. So we have two counterpropagating channels, but you remember there's a correlation with the spin. Only spin up is moving forward, and only spin down is moving backward. Therefore, if you hit some impurity, let's assume that the impurity is non-magnetic impurity, which preserves time reversal symmetry, then there's in principle two ways of going around the impurity and be kicked back. You can go around the impurity in a clockwise fashion, or you can go around the impurity in a counterclockwise fashion. But now, because there's a perfect correlation between the direction of motion and the spin orientation, in order to move back, you have to rotate the spin from up to down. Then, in the first case, you're rotating the spin from up to down clockwise, say, rotated by pi. Then, in the lower case, you're rotating the spin in the counterclockwise fashion, say, minus pi. What's the difference? Pi minus minus pi equals to 2 pi. What happens when you rotate the electron spin by 2 pi? The wave function goes exactly to the negative of itself. That's why these two reflection paths always interfere with each other destructively. And this is a robust topological principle. It's not like the, well, it uses the fact that the electrons are waves. And furthermore, this argument would not work for if you pick some integer spin particles. It only works for half integer spin particles, where you rotate by 2 pi, you get a minus sign. So you kind of sense that these things must, there must be something topological about it. And the actual topological invariant, I will spend a lot more time talking about it. But can you sense that there must be something very deep about it, right? That it relies on the fundamental quantum mechanical principle that rotating a spin by 2 pi give you minus 1. So that's why these two reflecting, even though you are getting them on the same two counterpropagating channels, but separating 4 = 2+2 is already very useful because this reflecting path is forbidden. Yeah?
Okay. You're assuming that the impurity makes the amplitudes for the two paths to be equal, right?
Yeah, and see, if you have non-magnetic impurity, by time reversal symmetry, they have to be equal.
Okay.
Yeah, and most impurities in semiconductors are non-magnetic. Yeah, so it's not as robust as the quantum Hall effect, but it's very, very good because the semiconductors are almost pure of magnetic impurities. So now it also gives you a principle. So then how do you kind of understand this kind of picture in another way in momentum space or in energy space? You have a conduction band and you have a valence band. And that's like your Dirac fermion. You have a positive energy state. You have a negative energy state, right? But sometimes when you have a solid and you miscut or cut in some particular direction, you can actually have surface states which live inside the forbidden bulk band gap region. But because they're exponentially localized on the surface, they don't have a real momentum K, They have imaginary momentum. So that's why they're exponentially localized, they're evanescent waves, and that's why they can live inside. And you say, well, is there a topological difference between here and here? And it looks very different, these two pictures, right? And when we ask about the topological difference, we mean we have to do some small distortions, right? Like you see the beginning of my talk, a cup is the same as donut because we can smoothly distort. So if you put some perturbation on the system, you will see that these crossings are usually lifted. They're not accidental, they're not protected by anything. And then if they're lifted once, you can lift them further, right? So then we will say that this picture is now fundamentally different, because we can call all the lower state to be the valence state and all the upper state to be the conduction state. So now what happens if you have this, that's another way to explain the robustness of the quantum spin Hall state. You have a conduction band, you have a valence band, you have something in the middle, but this edge state exactly since they live in the middle because they're localized at the edge, so they're like the evanescent waves, so they have imaginary momentum along one direction, so that's why they are allowed to live inside the bulk gap region. But then you have a red upspin going forward and a blue downspin going backward, and they cross at one point at k equals to zero. Now, we remember that in quantum mechanics, that because the electron, when you rotate by 2 pi, give you minus 1, the time reversal operator squared is also minus 1, right? Because if you have a spin up particle, you do time reversal, becomes spin down. You do time reversal again, becomes spin up. But in the process, it's like electron has been rotated by 2 pi. So the time reversal operator squared in quantum mechanics has two possible outcomes. It's 1 for integer spins, but minus 1 for half integer spins. In the case when it's minus 1, there's a fundamental theorem in quantum mechanics called Cramer's theorem, which says all states have to form doubly degenerate pairs. So at this crossing point, it's a time reversal invariant point. And at this point, they exactly form a doublet, which satisfies the Cramer's theorem. If you did some perturbation, which still preserves time reversal symmetry, and you avoid that crossing, you will violate Cramer's theorem. So this is like a Dirac point in 1 plus 1 dimensional edge. And that Dirac point is protected by time reversal symmetry. You cannot lift it up. And that's another way to say that there's a fundamental different classes of insulators, those which look like that, and those which look like that. And once you have a crossing, a knot has been tied, and you cannot untie it. It's kind of, yeah. So when you do something to it, you can shift the point of the height of the degeneracy, but you cannot lift the degeneracy. And that's kind of illustrated here. There's a topological difference of two classes of insulator. We will get to some more deeper field theoretical definition later, but roughly you understand there must be something quite fundamental about it. So now how do we make that to happen? It turns out that we need both quantum mechanics and relativity, right? So quantum mechanics has already been tremendously useful for electronics. The energy gap is due to the wave nature of the electrons, and now we're using the fact that electrons spin rotated by 2 pi give you minus 1. But how do you get this 4 equals to 2 plus 2 to happen in nature, right? You cannot tell electron what to do. 2 equals to 1 plus 1 happens fundamentally because of the Lorentz force. What is the force responsible for 4 equals to 2 plus 2? You see the picture that upspin is going clockwise around the sample, and downspin is going counterclockwise around the sample. So that coupling is called spin orbit coupling. So fundamentally, for this thing to work, you need relativity. You need the spin orbit coupling, which is only predicted by relativity. So quantum mechanics have this property, they're rotating spin 1 half by 2 pi give you minus 1, which we already used, but we have to somehow use relativity, which is a little bit of a bad news because it will tell you that it cannot work for silicon because silicon is too light. The relativistic effect gets bigger and bigger in heavier and heavier elements. And that's why after a little bit of searching, we zoom. So this is kind of the chart of all possible binary semiconductors. It's plotted in the two-dimensional space of energy gap and lattice constant. So it's a very, very useful plot because they color-coded the energy gap because the energy by Einstein-Planck formula translates into a color of light, wavelengths. So if you want to build, which we don't have here, a green laser, you know exactly which semiconductor to pick, right? But they also like to build sandwiches to stack one thing on top of each other. And that you can only go vertically because you don't want lattice constant to be too different. Right? So basically, we're guided by two principles when we predicted this material. One is we know from the it has to be a relativistic effect through spin orbit coupling. So it cannot possibly work for things like silicon and for things like carbon, which are just too light. The spin orbit coupling scales with either z squared or sometimes even z force. So it goes up very dramatically when you have high atomic numbers. But then I was also trained as a field theorist when I was a student. And I knew, for example, that if you have 2 plus 1 dimension, Dirac equation, a massive Dirac equation will induce a transimons term. But the sign of the transimons term depends on the sign of the mass. So it kind of tells you that if the mass changes sign, some topological term might occur, right? So one day when we look at this chart of semiconductors, suddenly we notice something very strange, that I said it's plotted in the space of energy and that is constant. But it turns out that the energy has absolute zero. That all the other conventional semiconductor has a positive energy gap, but there's one semiconductor called mercury telluride, which has a negative energy gap. And that is the hint which helped us to identify this material to be the topological insulator. And I will explain the reason. So now, most of you may be field theorists, you don't, I assume, because this is a colloquial talk, you don't need to know anything about quantum metaphysics. I will explain to you everything in a self-contained fashion. But you do know about atomic physics, so you know there's S level and there's a P level, okay? But roughly speaking, the S level merge together to form a band, that's the conduction band, and the P level merge together, they form a band, that's the valence band. But there's something more interesting, because the P level, as we get a little bit more advanced in quantum mechanics, we know that it has a spin orbit coupling. P level has L equals to 1, electron has spin S equals to 1/2. When they're coupled by the relativistic spin orbit effect, it splits into P3/2, which is 4-4 degenerate, and P1/2, which is 2-4 degenerate. And basically, what you are forming is not just a conduction band out of S and valence band out of P. The valence band actually further splits into these fourfold manifolds, which they call gamma 8 in crystallographic notation. But then this split off band is called P1/2. So there's some kind of spin orbit splitting, which happens in the atom. So now you can imagine that as you go to heavier and heavier element, that splitting gets larger and larger. Then at some point, it could happen that this splitting overwhelms the original level difference between S and P. And that's exactly what happens in mercury telluride. And it's as simple as that. That you have S, if you solve Schrödinger equation without spin orbit coupling, you identify S level and you identify P level. You put in the right magnitude of the spin orbit splitting, or you solve the Dirac equation for that atom, you find that the P3/2 level jumps above S. And that turned out to be the very important thing that happens. It changes the sign of the Dirac mass. So now you have this material, mercury telluride, which has this inverted behavior, the P above S, and you have, fortunately, you have an ordinary material, Kenyon telluride, which has exactly this, almost exactly the same lattice constant, but which is normal, which has S above P. So when you put them together to make a sandwich, you know at some thickness, the topological quantum phase transition has to happen. And that's when mercury telluride is very thin, everything should be conventional, right? After all, in the limit when it's zero, you should have S above P. But when mercury telluride is very thick, you should have P above S. So somewhere you predict there has to be a phase transition. And you do a simple calculation, it happens about 6 nanometers in thickness. So now why is this important? It's important because this system forms a Dirac system, okay? So you have the S levels, spin up, spin down. You have the P levels. Now we all learned that there are 3 P levels, but you always take the maximal spin orbit couple level. If you have electrons spin up, you take LZ equals to 1, which if you read Jackson is PX plus IPY. If you have electrons spin down, you take PX minus IPY orbital, okay? So then you put them on a lattice and you try to construct a very simple model of how the electron might hop on this lattice. To the lowest order, the upstream block and downstream block are not even coupled to each other. So it further reduces to a 2x2 matrix in the upstream block and the conjugate of that in the downstream block. So in the diagonal element, you have the SP level difference. Okay? So that appears like a mass term, but the crucial thing is that we can do something that high energy physics cannot do, right? Dirac mass is just given. But here, the mass term we can tune continuously simply by changing the thickness. Well, it's because it's an effective Dirac equation, simply by changing the thickness. But more dramatically, we can even change the sign of the Dirac mass. And that's the peculiar thing that happens in this material. But then when you look at the S and P level coupling, we know that they have the opposite parity. So they cannot couple at k equals to 0. So the lowest order coupling has to be linear in k. And that's how the Dirac structure emerges. And when you look at the long wavelength limit, you see this is exactly the Dirac equation in 2 plus 1 dimension, because the Dirac equation in 2 plus 1 dimension is only two components, right? But it has a mass. But you remember the Dirac equation, the mass breaks time reversal. But in this case, it's OK, because we have a time reversal symmetry breaking here, but the opposite thing happening in the lower block. And that's why this is called quantum spin Hall effect. The two spins have the opposite Hall conductance, and that's why it's okay. So now, if I'm talking to condensed matter theorist, I have to spend a long time to explain why changing the sign of Dirac mass is important. But you're all field theorists, mostly of you are field theorists here. You all know that if I have a massive Dirac equation coupled to external electromagnetic field, I induce a Chern-Simons term. But the sign of the Chern-Simons term changes if I change the sign of mass. So basically, if you change mass from positive to negative, you have a jump in the Hall conductance, right? So if you can continuously tune this mass simply by changing the thickness of the quantum well, and if you can tune into a regime where it's negative, and outside is like positive, so it makes the sample boundary look like a domain wall. If you solve, you can apply periodic boundary condition along x direction, some fixed boundary condition along y direction, and if the mass of the Dirac equation changes sign, the sample boundary looks like a domain wall. So you trap one state for one given momentum along x direction. Then when you change the momentum along the x direction, it will change its energy, and that's what gives rise to the dispersion. Okay, so therefore you predict that in this material you will have edge state and you have exactly 4 equals to 2 plus 2. You have one edge state for the upstream block on the upper one, one soliton on the upper edge, one soliton on the lower edge because that's where the mass changes sign, and you have the opposite thing happening for the downstream block. And then you see that they have a Dirac-like dispersion, and you always ask this good question whether this Dirac point is protected or not, and we already went through the argument. It is protected as long as you have time reversal symmetry because they have to form a Kramer's doublet. So then we got very excited. Our paper got immediately accepted in Science magazine, and then we know that there's one group which has been the leader in this material called Mercury Terrorite. They built this wonderful structure. I don't need to tell you the details. You only need to remember there's two tuning parameters they have. One is the thickness of the cheese. So they make a sandwich. The important thing is the mercury terrorite layer. And then they can apply a gate voltage. So by applying a gate voltage, they basically can change the Fermi level. Okay? So then what we predict is that when the thickness is less than some magic number, which is 6.5 nanometer, you have a conduction band, you have a valence band, and you have nothing in between. Okay, so as you tune the Fermi level from conduction band to valence band, when you get into the middle region, the resistance should be infinite because there's nothing that can possibly conduct. Okay, so then when you go build a quantum well which has a thicker, something like 7 nanometer in thickness, then you have a conduction band, you have a valence band, but in the middle you have this one pair of edge states that cross at a time reversal invariant point. And then when they tune the gate voltage, they go from conduction band, you have some conductance, to valence band, they have some conductance. But then in the middle, you have exactly two extra pair of edge states, one on each edge, which is doing the conduction. So that you predict will have a quantized conductance of 2e squared over h. But furthermore, dramatically, if you change the this highway, if you change the two lanes farther or closer, you expect no change because you just count the number of lanes and you still have two lanes. So this is completely opposite to Ohm's law, right? Ohm's law tells you that if you change, if I make have a resistor have a larger cross-section, a smaller cross-section, the one with larger cross-section should have smaller resistance. But if the conduction only happens at the edge, it doesn't care. And that's why you can also check the quantization as a function of the geometry of the sample. So that's the discovery made in 2007. But then afterwards, we also generalize these to the three-dimensional context. We have a material called bismuth 2 selenium 3. They form this kind of quintuple unit cell. And to make a long story short, they basically form a kind of a three-dimensional massive Dirac system. Very roughly speaking, it's mostly the p orbitals of these atoms which are playing a role. And to the lowest order, if it has a quintuple layered structure but has a center of inversion, you first want to form the parity eigenstate, or which are bonding and antibonding state. And that happens at the first stage, and you have the bonding of the bismuth and the antibonding of the selenium. And then you have a crystal field splitting because it has a layered structure. The three p orbitals are not the same, and only the pz orbitals are relevant. And now the important thing is that when you increase the magnitude of spin orbit coupling, which you can do as a theorist continuously, you find that there's a change of the sign of the mass. So here, I will appeal again to the field theorist, and you remember something you learned about the sign of the Dirac equation in 3 plus 1 dimension, okay? So naively, the Dirac equation has a chiral symmetry. You can rotate the M5 mass and M4 mass continuously, but actually there's an anomaly. So if you change the sign of the mass, the theta angle will rotate. And if you go from mass from positive to negative, the theta angle will rotate from 0 to pi. And that's actually the theta angle of being pi is basically the fundamental definition of what is a topological insulator. But here I'm giving you the microscopic explanation how it happens that you can change the sign of the mass. So you're not getting any T-breaking mass because the mass is going from positive to negative. But in the process, the theta angle has to rotate by pi, which is the story, the kind of real story I will tell you just a little bit later. So if you have that situation, you again solve the tight binding model, you'll find that there's a cluster of four materials, and only for these three materials have enough spin orbit coupling. So that you have, so the real life is a little bit more complicated, not simple Dirac-like parabola. You can compute it very accurately by numerical calculations. It has some conduction band, it has some wiggles, it has valence band. None of these features are universal. The universal feature is that it has a single Dirac cone. So we have now a three-dimensional material, we have a two-dimensional surface state. You can have two momenta, and they sweep out a Dirac cone. And the Dirac cone is degenerate at one point, which is the time reversal invariant point. And at that point, its masslessness is protected by the time reversal symmetry. They have to form a Kramer's doublet. And this is the actual model, which you can saw. But you find that on the surface, it's a massless Dirac, a single copy of massless Dirac. And that you can prove by a generalization of the Neilson-Nonomiya theory. That you can prove that if you have a two-dimensional system with half integer spin, no matter how hard you work, you can never, ever get a single copy of Dirac, okay? And a single copy of Dirac can only happen holographically if it is the boundary of a three-dimensional thing. That's why everything is consistent. Well, in condensed matter physics, you also learned in recent years that there's another two-dimensional Dirac system, which is called graphene. But when you look at the details, it has four Dirac points, not one. So having even number is okay, but having a single Dirac cone is holographic. It can only happen when it's the boundary. It's like the impossibility to put neutrino on a lattice. You cannot put a single copy of Dirac in a two-dimensional system if it's half integer spin. So now people can immediately do all sorts of experiments. And one experiment that's relatively easy to do is to use, again, the very effect that Einstein got the Nobel Prize for. It's the photoelectric effect. You come in with the photon, you kick out the electron, and by analyzing the energy and momentum loss, you can map out the dispersion relation of the surface state. And you indeed see this beautiful Dirac-like surface state. And on the cover of the Physics Today, it's real data, just more nicely processed, a single Dirac cone. And that was done at Stanford. The Princeton group, led by Sahid Hassan, did also pioneering experiment. It's on another material called bismuth 2 selenium 3. And so this is the Dirac cone. And furthermore, they have checked it on the surface of the Dirac cone. Usually, for one momentum, you can have spin up, spin down. But here, there's one unique momentum. The spin is always transverse to the momentum. So it forms a helical structure on the surface. So now let me tell you about more theory. And so historically, there are two developments in this field. One is called the topological field theory, which I like to tell you about. And the other is called the topological band theory, which very recently it has been proved that they are equivalent in the non-interacting limit. But for most of you, I think the idea of a topological field theory is a lot easier to understand, right? So it's very, very simple to do these things. You just ask, what are the allowed topological terms? In 2 plus 1, the topological term is a transaminance term. In 3 plus 1, the topological term we all know about is the theta term, okay? So in elementary language, if I have an insulator, and let's, for the moment, imagine that I put period, you give me a Hamiltonian for some insulator, it can be arbitrary interacting or so on, but I put it in a periodic boundary condition. Then if I integrate out all the electrons, I will get some effective electromagnetic action, right? So the first term I will get is the F mu squared. But in a solid, I can have two phenomenological constants, the dielectrical constant and the magnetic permeability, right? So any ordinary insulator will have these, are defined by these two non-universal numbers. But in principle, I can also get a F dual term with a theta angle. In the proper units we choose, theta is multiplied by universal constant, which is nothing but a fine structure constant, E squared over H bar C. Now, in a periodic system, when you change theta by 2 pi, nothing changes. So therefore, there's a periodicity, and that's why it's topological, right? So now, why don't we usually write down such a term? We usually don't write down such a term because it breaks time reversal symmetry, right? Because E is even under time reversal, but B is odd. So E dot B, or F dual, breaks time reversal. That's why it's related to the strong CP problem, right? But under the time reversal operation, E changes sign, B changes, E doesn't change sign, B changes sign, so E dot B changes sign. So effectively, it's like saying theta goes to minus theta, right? But there's one unique value of theta when theta equals to pi. Theta goes to minus pi, pi goes to minus pi, but theta is periodic in 2 pi. Minus pi is identified with pi. So only in this very special situation, it is also time reversal symmetric. So you immediately realize or understand that all insulators in the universe can be folded into two different categories, one which has theta equals to zero, and the other has theta equals to pi. That's the kind of the macroscopic symmetry reasoning, right? But I also explained to you the microscopics, that in some solid, because of the strength of the spin orbit coupling, the mass can change sign. And you, being field theorists, all know very well that when you change the sign of the Dirac mass, you go from theta from zero to theta equals to pi. That's why there exists these non-trivial insulators in nature, which are driven by strong spin orbit coupling, which give you this topological insulated state. So another way to understand is that, again, in a perfect field theoretical language, if I have theta FF dual, it is nothing but a boundary term, but the FF dual is the derivative of the transaminance term. So you see that if I have a bulk term, all the interesting physics is happening on the surface, right? So if the interesting thing is happening on the surface, then we know that the transaminance term corresponds to some Pohr effect. So then if theta equals to pi, what is the whole conductance it corresponds to? It corresponds to exactly 1/2 E squared over H. And that is exactly the parity anomaly in 2 plus 1 dimension, right? So if you have Dirac mass term, if you integrate out a single copy of Dirac in the massless limit, you will still get 1/2. So having 1/2 or theta equals 2 pi tells you that there's a single Dirac cone living on the surface. So every story, in any different way you look at it, is consistent. So the way we come up with this topological field theory was actually first think about that if you have a 2 plus 1 dimensional quantum Hall effect described by a Trin-Simons term, what's the most natural thing you do? You find that the most natural thing is to write down a Trin-Simons term in 4 plus 1. Okay? And so so it went through a twisted path. We first understand everything about quantum Hall effect in 4 plus 1 because it's the most obvious and natural generalization. But now we understand this two-dimensional state and the three-dimensional state are all dimensional descendants. There's a well-defined mathematical algorithm in the theory of anomaly called descendant equation. That if you understand a 4 plus 1 dimensional quantum Hall effect, you can dimensionally reduce. And you can reduce only by two steps. So you get a 3 plus 1 dimensional topological insulator, and you can get a 2 plus 1 dimensional topological insulator. So the two plus one dimensional thing is the mercury terite that I explained to you, and the three dimensional thing is the bismuth selenide that I explained to you. So the theory is very simple, that if you have a kind of a lattice system in 2 plus 1 dimension, and if you integrate out all the fermions, in principle, you can get a Trin-Simons term. But the Trin-Simons term in 2 plus 1 dimension necessarily breaks time reversal, right? And the time reversal, A0 goes to A0, but AI goes to minus AI, right? Because B equals to curl of A. B changes sign in the time reversal, so the spatial A has to change sign in the time reversal. So the Trin-Simons term has something like, for example, A0 partial X AY. So it changes sign in the time reversal, and that's why it's in the T-breaking class. And the coefficient of it is the first Trin number. So it's very nice and topological. So it's the only topological thing you can write down. 2 plus 1, you can write down a Trin-Simons term. And then the momentum space is only two-dimensional. So you can only write down a first Trin number. So then the most natural generalization is into 4 plus 1. Okay? But in 4 plus 1, you immediately realize that the Trin-Simons term preserves time reversal symmetry. Because you get A wedge dA wedge dA. So you have an extra spatial A. So under time reversal, A0 goes to A0, but AI goes to minus AI as before. But now you have one extra A in the Trin-Simons Lagrangian. So the Trin-Simons term in 4 plus 1 necessarily preserves time reversal symmetry, whereas the Trin-Simons term in 2 plus 1 breaks time reversal. So you immediately understand that there must be a time reversal invariant class which identifies the quantum Hall effect, the higher dimensional generalization. And these are the time reversal invariant topological insulators. And then the coefficient of it must be a second Trin number, F wedge F, but in momentum space. So this is kind of the most obvious and natural generalization. But at that time, condensed matter physicists never see why you can go to four dimensions. It sounds like a very, very strange idea, right? But in a way, we have gone once to four dimensions because when you try to understand critical phenomena, it's best to go to four dimensions, and then you come lower by the epsilon expansion. So I will show you that the best way to understand all these topological insulators is to first go to four dimensions, and then you can perform dimensional reduction just like you would do when it goes from string theory to any for 3 plus 1 dimensional system. So if you have such a Trin-Simons term, then you can compactify the extra dimension. Let's call the extra dimension X5. Right? You compactify the extra dimension just like Kaluza-Klein did into a circle. But then the A5 can have, in principle, a non-trivial flux through that circle. Right? So that's the theme that occurs always in compactification, right? So when you go from 4 plus 1 to 3 plus 1, the extra flux throughout the compactified dimension occurs like the axion field, okay? So if you have Trin-Simons, so basically this A becomes the axion field, then you have F dual, and that that's the theta vacuum term you can have. But remember that the original trans-Hammond's term in 4 plus 1 preserves time reversal symmetry. So when you compactify, you would like to preserve the time reversal symmetry. But now you have some extra flux throughout your compactified dimension. But then there's only two values. If flux is equal to 0, it preserves, obviously, preserve time reversal symmetry. But also when the flux equals to pi, that would also break preserve time reversal symmetry. So the whole story of topological insulator is just the fact that there are such insulators which corresponds to theta equals to pi. But this is the full effective field theory of topological insulator. It's F dual and theta F times F wedge F, okay? And then the theta angle, you just dimensionally reduce F wedge F in four-dimensional momentum space to a trans-Hammond's form in the three-dimensional momentum space. So you can explicitly, for any given material, you can explicitly compute the theta angle and know whether it's 0 or pi. And so it becomes a very simple theory now. So in the quantum Hall effect is A wedge A in 2 plus 1 with the first Chern number in momentum space. The effective field theory for the 3 plus 1 dimensional topological insulator is A wedge F dual F, F wedge F or FF dual, which is the theta term. And the theta angle in a lattice system can be expressed as the three-dimensional momentum space because you have a three-dimensional solid, but of the trans-Hammond's form in momentum space. So that's a beautiful and closed theory, and we know how exactly go from one to the other through these descendant relationships. And that recently it has been proven that this reduces in the non-interacting limit to the topological band theory, which was first constructed in a very nice paper by Charlie Kane and Millie. So now, how do you do experiment to detect the theta angle? So it's actually very similar to what people are proposing for how to detect the axion field in the early universe from the evolution. Basically, you remember they say that if the cosmic background radiation passes through the axion field, it leads to a rotation of the polarization angle, okay? So now you have this piece of solid called topological insulator. What we propose to do is we apply a magnetic field, and then you look at light hitting on that surface and reflecting back. And in this case, the polarization angle of the light will be rotated. Now, it's not surprising that any material, when you put a magnetic field, it will lead to such an effect. It's either called, when it's reflecting, it's called Kerr effect. When it's transmitting, it's called the Faraday effect. The profound thing about topological insulator is that when you let the magnetic field go into zero limit, it has a finite intercept, okay? So that rotation angle is dimensionless. When you take the tangent of it, it's also dimensionless, and it is the fine structure constant. So the tangent of the rotation angle of the topological insulator is given by the fine structure constant. So we have some more refined proposal which will allow you to measure maybe the quantization in units of the fine structure constant in a very precise way. Another thing is you remember Witten's famous prediction that if you have a theta angle, it leads to electromagnetic duality. Charge will have a monopole charge. Monopole will have an electric charge. Right? So then we predict a very remarkable phenomenon, that you take a piece of insulator and you put a charge on top. And in high school physics, we learned that you will induce an image charge. But if you put that on top of a topological insulator, the image will be a magnetic monopole, exactly because of the theta angle is equals to pi, okay? So, and that is actually a doable experiment, and I think somewhere, either this year or next year, it will be announced, it will be done, okay? And now you can also ask whether this theta angle, which for a given non-magnetic topological insulator is fixed to be either zero or pi. But what if you introduce a lot of magnetic dopants into the material? Then they can set in some magnetic order, and that magnetic order can dynamically fluctuate. In the case when that dynamically fluctuates, it can behave exactly like a dynamical axion field. So again, so you have a theta angle, which is precisely computable. And then if they set in some magnetic order, the amplitude of the magnetic order can oscillate. And that oscillation couples to electromagnetic field exactly like a dynamical epsilon field. So the epsilon field will have some mass, and it couples to F wedge F exactly like the epsilon field. So you can do laboratory experiments to test the dynamics of the epsilons. So of course, the story you make is that you can, by studying things on the on your desktop, you can study things like epsilon, which is a candidate of dark matter. And you think nobody will take it seriously, but at least Frank Wilczek does. So he thinks that this could be a kind of a way to understand something about at least these equations that we write down to see somewhere in nature being realized. It's an important thing. So now, maybe let me use the last 2 minutes. We talked about the idea is that you always try to fractionalize, right? You write 4 equals to 2 plus 2, which is the quantum spin Hall effect. You write 2 equals to 1 plus 1, which is the quantum Hall effect. You will say, what's the next step? You may think it's 8 equals to 4 plus 4, but that's not the case. The case is to write something like 1 equals to 1 half plus 1 half. Right, so on the edge state of quantum Hall effect, it looks like it's already very elemental. You only have 1 degree of freedom, which is a chiral fermion in 1 plus 1. You say, what can be smaller than that? The answer is chiral Majorana. You know that in 1 plus 1, you can impose not just chiral condition, but you can also impose Majorana condition. If you impose both of them at the same time, basically the chiral Majorana fermion is the most elemental object you can think of. Right? So that can happen if you have a topological superconductor. Okay? And then the edge states are also chiral, but they're chiral Majorana. So in the chiral state, you have a linear dispersion, but you can have particle-like excitations and you can have hole-like excitations. But if you have a chiral Majorana, you can only have particle excitation. The hole, it's because it's a real fermion, the hole is identified with the particle. Okay? But that kind of situation only happens when you have a superconductor. So for example, if you have a superfluid state, a helium-3 B phase, you can find that the Hamiltonian for it is identical to the topological insulator Hamiltonian I already introduced. So at least in the case of topological insulator, you have experimentally identified a Dirac cone. But in writing such a Hamiltonian, maybe you also know there's something called the Nambu notation. You write the fermion operator, usually it's C and C dagger, but you put C and C dagger into a single column vector. So when you write down a Hamiltonian, you already artificially double the degree of freedom. So if you solve and you get an edge surface state, which is a single Dirac fermion, the right interpretation of that, it's actually a single Majorana fermion. Because in writing down the Hamiltonian, you already doubled the degree of freedom. It's always particle hole symmetric. So the whole part is just a redundant, you have to impose a reality condition in the end. So the news is that there's one real system, at least in nature, the helium-3 B phase, which realizes the Majorana surface state. Okay, and the experiments are being done now. So basically, I think we're in a very exciting phase, right? Einstein taught us to formulate laws of physics in terms of geometry, but when you look at the standard model, they're basically following that recipe. But there's a deeper question you can ask, why we should always formulate the laws of nature in terms of geometrical field equations. But in the standard model, we see that there is at least one topological term in the standard model, which we still don't fully understand. But very interestingly, it's exactly that term that defines and describes this topological insulator. And that's why Frank Wilczek at least believes that it can shed some light into fundamental physics. Thank you very much.
Topological phase.
Ah, very good, very good. Oh, you really want to go to the nuts and bolts. No. It's a second order. It's a mess. Yeah. But level crossing, you can both be first order. The whole conductance and things like jump, but it's basically described by a Dirac mass going to zero. So there's a divergent correlation that's associated with that. So basically, what happened to the edge state? So what's the physical interpretation of the divergent correlation lens? It's exactly the localization lens of the edge state. So if you are in one phase, the edge state are localized near the edge by some lens. And as you tune closer to the transition, the edge state get fatter and fatter and fatter. Then eventually, they go into the bulk and they annihilate each other. So there is a divergent correlation lens associated with it.
But
the level crossing, you can say you have Dirac vacuum, you have the minimum and maximum, and they are crossing, right? So I think the natural definition is there's a divergent correlation. But in this sense, it's a kind of a trivial free field theory. It has a divergent, but so far nobody looked into anomalous dimension and so on. Yeah, because in one case, let's say it has a theta equals to pi, and in the other case, it has theta equals to zero. The topology is different. Yeah. So you're changing the topological angle.
You said something that you cannot put a chiral fermion in a 2D lattice?
No. In the 2D lattice, you cannot put a single copy of Dirac. So for example, if you build a honeycomb lattice and you put fermion, you immediately see the rock comb. But there are two copies. There's a double.
Say if I put on square lattice?
It's even worse. The best chance is to put on the honeycomb.
You would have double.
Yeah,
but there is this...
massless rock.
Yes, but there is a Ginsburg-Wilson formalism.
Yeah. So what I do is very similar to Ginsburg. So basically, what's very important is the second, the quadratic term. Yeah. This system has a time reversal symmetry. So at the massless point, you do have a single copy of Dirac, but it has both spin up and spin down. So that leads to a doubling. So the minimal Dirac fermion, massless Dirac fermion, you can have in a two-dimensional system is 2.
Even in the Ginsburg-Wilson?
Yeah, massless Dirac. It depends on whether you how you impose the time reversal symmetry. Here, because the time reversal symmetry has to have t squared equals to minus 1. Mm-hmm. If you have one Dirac cone, you have to have the Kramer's particle. Comes from the Kramer's theory.
Yeah.
So there are several proposals, one by Wu and King, and one more recently by us. It looks like the very important first step is to create a Majorana point particle. So if you have a Majorana point particle, just one, you don't even know how to define it. But if you have two Majorana point-like levels equals to one kind of complex fermion level. If you have one complex fermion level, you can define a bit, 0 or 1, right? But here, because only two Majorana together makes one quantum bit, and you can separate this one quantum bit very, very fast spatially, it's kind of storing one quantum bit non-locally. And you know that local perturbation cannot decohere. So it's supposed to be, that's the kind of one direction people are thinking. It's supposed to be more robust than ordinary. It's kind of an oxymoron to say ordinary quantum computer, but non-topological quantum computer.
That's
it's a